Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at lots of things in the science arena today on the show. Bassam Shakashiri is back with us to begin the show. He's an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, a national proponent for science and education. And we're going to talk about a number of things, climate change, one of them to begin with. And we'll also learn about the scientist Carl Gerassi and hear about the Halloween demonstrations Bassam did during his chemistry classes. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions about changes in Wisconsin's climate, perhaps? Why is climate change the issue keeping you up at night? Bassam can answer what other science question you might have in your mind. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Very happy to be with you and with our listeners, Larry, and happy Halloween day to you.
Yeah, to you as well. Here we are in a global warming kind of climate change situation. The problem is huge. There are people who are working towards solutions. That's it's a kind of a Halloween trick that we're getting played on here, I think. But people are working on it. But when it comes to climate change, where are we headed?
Larry, you and I and our listeners have conversed before about this challenge. This is the greatest challenge that humanity faces. It is affecting all of us, and all of us must participate in addressing ways to mitigate global warming. There are natural causes for global warming. There's no doubt about that. But human activity since the Industrial Revolution has greatly increased the number and amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And this has contributed to increasing the temperature of the planet. These changes are inexorable. We cannot change, we cannot stop them, but we can mitigate them. And that's why I am wanting to invite our listeners to participate in a conversation about the effects of global warming on us locally, regionally, globally. What are the economic ramifications? What is science telling us about what we must do to address, successfully address these changes, and how all of us can work, not only individually, but collectively and on a regional basis and a national basis around the globe to successfully address this most challenging, change to humanity. So, you know, we've made some progress. For one thing, more people are talking about global warming. More people are engaged in developing green solutions. More people are aware and are taking action to reduce our dependence on the use of fossil fuels as sources of energy. It's all for the good, but it requires continuous and continual action on our part, thoughtful action, responsible action, so that we can succeed in mitigating global warming. And I really would like to hear from our listeners about this, because this is not a singular activity. This is a collective societal activity for those of us in the listening audience, for everyone in Wisconsin and the neighboring states, for everyone around the globe.
Well, there, I was thinking about things that that are occurring. I mean, you look at, for example, the movement to solar energy has been, and wind energy, but especially solar. I'm seeing a lot of it here in Wisconsin, at least around the areas where I live, and I'm also seeing, as I travel elsewhere, well, even in Wisconsin, I see a lot in the area of wind power, and I see, I'm reading that the number of electric cars, for example, that it won't be that many years that the cars that are sold on the market will be all electric.
The sooner the better in doing and having all of us observe what you're just sharing with us, Larry, is crucial. Yes, there are very good signs of change. Solar, wind, using electric vehicles, and all of this has economic consequences. But we as individuals and we as groups collectively have to understand and act in responsible ways so that we mitigate global warming. And that's why I once again invite listeners to call in and express their views about this. The global warming is unequivocal. There's no doubt that it is happening. Now, there's some people who want to engage in conversations of whether it's a hoax or it is this or it's that. All right, you want to talk about this? We can talk about that, but we need to talk about responsible action and what we do in our classrooms to teach the students who are going to be living in a warmer planet, what we do in our communities, what we do in industry, what the government does, not only local, state, and federal government, but all governments around the world, engage in meaningful, forward-looking programs that are not only funded, but are evaluated, reviewed, modified. That's what we need. That's the kind of action that we need.
And with so the impacts, I was just thinking as you were talking about my daughter, Emily, who's she's a marine biology major in college. And so I've been paying more attention to what the what our seas and our waters and how the life in those waters and so forth is changing and how it might impact her in terms of her own career and life down the road.
And these are the kinds of concerns that I'm calling on everyone in our listening audience to think about and to act. How are these changes going to affect us individually and collectively? So let me ask our audience a question that relates to what you just said. What are the largest greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere? Would someone call in and tell me what they think the top three or four greenhouse gases that are causing increasing the temperature of the planet? And one of them is related to what Emily's studying.
Yeah.
Let's see if we get a reaction.
And we have some questions not directly relating to that, but I know Vern in Eau Claire County wondered. The Hunga volcanic eruptions have had a huge effect, I guess, on our climate. They changed the shape of the seafloor. And I'm wondering if you had heard about this eruption and whether or not it could have an effect on our climate.
Yes, these are part of the natural causes for a global warming, volcanic eruptions. And these eruptions release a variety of chemicals, including water vapor, and then there are ramifications. They also release material that contains sulfur, and sulfur-containing gases tend to reflect sunlight and could possibly be helping us mitigate global warming. So there are many studies, confirmed studies, about the effect of volcanic activities and what they do to us. And those are the volcanic activities or activities we cannot do anything about. We should know what they are, what their effects are, so that we can then decide how to help mitigate global warming by lowering our dependence on the use of fossil fuels, which contribute to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, which is one of the greenhouse gases. So there is a lot of interconnections between what happens naturally and what human activity continues to do. And that's the essence of what I'm trying to say, understanding how these interactions take place and what we as inhabitants of this planet must do to mitigate global warming.
Jack in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Jack, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing. What can we do for you today?
Well, you know, so I heard you talking about EVs and other, you know, renewable things, and those are all pretty awesome. And it's all good to take those small steps toward to mitigate climate change and global warming. I don't know if this sounds like a really fringe view, but I always thought, you know, hearing how bad, you know, climate change is supposed to get in the next couple of years, what can we do to work to reverse it, I guess, both in the short term and the long term, if you or your guest could speak to that?
Mm-hmm. Larry, I didn't quite make what you said.
He was wondering what are some actions we can take in both the short term and the long term. What can we do to reverse global warming?
Well, very good question. Thank you, Jack, for that. The individually, we can do lots of things. We can switch to more efficient modes of transportation. As Larry mentioned, electric cars will help us use less fossil fuels, less petroleum, less gasoline. For transportation, we can lower our thermostat because many homes, many buildings are heated using the combustion of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas. We can set our goals so that we collectively together. Make decisions about new construction, new buildings, new roads, and how they affect the environment. All of this requires a better understanding of what is really happening to our planet and how we are contributing to it and how we can actually try to control it better. Now, so there are short-term things we can do, and the long-term things that we must do involve huge collaboration among communities, states, countries to do this. The telltale of what is happening, the telltales are very clear. We have extreme weather changes. We have an increased amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. We have effects on marine life in the ocean as the ocean acidification increases. There are all kinds of factors like this. And I'd like to call attention to something that I have posted on my website. It's actually a workbook for high school science teachers and for university science faculty. It deals with activities that they can engage in with their students in the classroom. It's not a new curriculum. It is ways to incorporate ideas that relate to mitigating global warming into existing curriculum. So if I invite you to go to my website, scifun, scifun.org. Or just Google Science is Fun, and that's the first thing that shows up. Near the top of the homepage, you'll find the link to this workbook. And one specific thing you can do, Jack, and everyone else, is recommend this to the teachers and to the faculty that you know in your immediate community. So that's one specific thing that can be done.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us today to talk science. We're dealing with climate change now. We'll talk other things as well with him as we go along today. Clara Neipert's our producer, by the way. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking science today and zeroing in a bit to start the show here on climate change with Bassam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison. Callers online, we got some emails. Let's go to Paul in West Bend next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Help me out. To create a unit of energy to move your car, propellant, you burn coal at a power station, and then you're going to use the steam to turn a turbine. Now you're going to take that unit of energy and move it across transmission lines to a receptacle at in your garage, and you're going to charge your battery. So my question is, the efficiency of the power station burning the coal versus and the line loss getting the unit of energy to your garage to go into your battery, tell me if that's more efficient than burning a gasoline-driven engine.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul, for this question. This is the kind of conversation we should be having to understand what the consequences are of changing from fossil fuels to others, and look at not only efficiency, but look at the wide scope of participation of everyone has to do that. So there are some technical questions. There are some economic questions. There are ways by which we can reach good make good decisions and reach take action that will help us reach the goals that we want. So, Paul, that's what it is. Yes, not everything is as efficient as it should be, but that means that we should try to make it more efficient. And understanding the economic consequences of switching from petroleum products for our energy needs to electric. Yes, those are the kinds of questions that we should be discussing.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thank you for calling. Irene in Middleton, on to you. Hi, Irene.
Oh, hey, I'm on speaker. Tell me if it's a problem for you.
No, it's good.
I'm just driving over here to Trader Joe's, and I'm noticing that I make a habit of always trying to engage the battery in my hybrid car, so I'm not using any gas. But maybe some day-to-day advice for people who have gas-powered cars on how to maximize efficiency, burn less fuel when traveling, just day-to-day things that people can do to just cut down on the emissions that they create. And also maybe talk about these newfangled at-home composters. And if it's okay, I'll take my the answer off the air because I'm now at Trader Joe's.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Irene. This is important what you just said because that's the kind of thing that we want everyone to participate in discussing and taking action. Yes, all of this helps. Look, the batteries in the hybrid cars, the batteries in the electric vehicles, they have to be prepared. They have to. They will involve the use of chemicals, materials. There's a cost to that. All of this has to be taken into consideration. And what we must do is engage in conversations about all of this. There is no simple solution to any of this. There is no magic bullet to deal with this. This is a very complex dynamic human situation, and everyone's participation is important. And for some of the questions that are raised, including some that I have, there are no answers yet. But that should not stop us from being responsible and caring by engaging in these conversations. Thank you, Irene.
Mm-hmm. On to Donnie in Duluth. Your turn. Hi, Donnie.
Hey, I agree with a lot of the stuff that's being said here, especially about the vastness of this quote-unquote problem. We really don't know the bottom line of what's going on here because there's so many factors. Like earlier you were talking about volcanoes and other natural events and man's participation and everything else. It seems like a lot of the energy goes towards this get off gas and get on electric. But, boy, making them batteries, like you had just said, is a chemical process, and it's mighty dirty as well. Not to mention you got to charge those batteries, and that energy comes from somewhere. So unless you're getting it from solar, you're kind of spinning your wheels. But here, having said all of that, it seems like a big thing is transportation, gas cars, hybrid cars. Well, I'm almost 60 years old. I've driven many cars in my life, and I've always kept track of the gas mileage because I'm just weird that way. Now, I've found something. When I'm driving and I don't stop, my gas mileage dang near doubles. I live in Duluth. How many times have I come down Mesaba Hill just to have the stoplight stop you, all those cars moving, and then go again or up the hill or whatever? We've got so much technology and so much smartness out there with all of our gadgets. Why can't we have roads that keep the traffic flowing? If you had a traffic cop on every corner saying, go, go, you stop now, you go, now you can go, you go, if the traffic would never have to stop. And there's no reason we can't come up with stoplights and roads and stuff that move the flow of traffic. If the car doesn't stop, you save gas, like dang near double. It seems like a much bigger, more sweeping approach than people worrying about their thermostats and stuff, while China and every other country is pumping it into the air by tons. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Donnie, thanks for calling. Comments, Bassam.
Yes, very good observations, Donnie. And it is at the heart of what I'm trying to get all of us to think about and to do. Yes, change of any sort requires not only individual but collective responsibility. So traffic flow, frequency of traffic, you know, how often you drive, whether we use public transportation for wherever we're going, all of these factors are part of what we should be thinking about. You know why? Because we're all concerned about the quality of life that we have, the quality of life currently and the quality of life in the future, the quality of life for us, the quality of life for our children, for our grandchildren. And it is crucial that we ask those kinds of questions and try to make decisions about ways to improve the way by which we interact with each other, transportation being one of them. You know, how often do you want to fly? What kind of air freight fuel is being used? And so on. There are all kinds of very important, interesting, technical as well as societal questions that we should be talking about. And that's why I keep saying, let us engage in meaningful and respectful conversation about changes. Let us try to understand that human activity since the Industrial Revolution is causing bigger effects on the climate than the natural occurrences. And let's try to understand why statements like that are accurate. Let's challenge each other so that we can converse respectfully and try to understand so we can take responsible action.
Donnie, thank you very much for calling. Pat in Deerfield emailed us, how can we stay enthused about mitigating climate change when today's politicians refuse to act and some deniers continue to be elected? Feels like a hopeless battle.
It's not hopeless, Pat. If you say it's hopeless and everyone says it's hopeless, it's over. No, we engage in respectful conversations with our elected officials. And if they do not represent us, if they do not act for the common good, this is why they're elected. So they would act for the common good, not for their own good. I don't want to get into that right now, but I can if you want me to. This is why we have elections. This is how our democracy works. This is how our country, this is how our nation works. So we get to vote. We're going to be voting next year. We make sure that those who are elected represent us, all of us, and act for the common good of society. As far as deniers are concerned, I'm an advocate of having conversations with them about what it is that they deny. Is it some misunderstanding? Is it complete understanding, incomplete understanding? What is it? That's why I say, let us visit with each other and let us always be respectful of each other, respectful as fellow human beings. I'm not saying we respect somebody else's ideas necessarily. We could, but the discourse has to be based on trust, has to be based on respect, so that we can get ourselves out of this very important challenge that we face as human beings.
You know, Paul in Wausau has a comment or a question that I think relates to what you just said. So let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hello. My question is, you know, over the years, we see science and then we see a counter that says the first one was wrong. And we know there's bad science out there. The food pyramid, the old food pyramid, was one thing. But so how do we, as lay people, know the difference between real science and junk science?
Very good, Paul. Yes, there is bad science out there, but science is a process. Science provides us with knowledge. This knowledge is not fixed. It's always subject to more scrutiny, to more examination, to more investigation. So we learn more. Science is self-correcting. Good science is self-correcting. Bad science is done by bad scientists. That's a different story. That's a bad story. That is borderline inhumane as far as I'm concerned. So I think we reason with each other. We try to understand the rationale for making statements, and then we try to see how we can develop corrections to our understanding that will yield a better and deeper understanding of the changes that are taking place. That's how science works. That's what science is. That's what technology and science relate to. Science attempts to give us an understanding of the beautiful, complex world that we live in. Technology, what's the purpose of technology? The purpose of technology is to improve the human condition. Now, as we try to improve the human condition, we sometimes, frequently, encounter side effects that are not good. That's what happened in the Industrial Revolution. We don't depend on horses and carts for transportation anymore. We use vehicles. Well, that's a transformation that happened. Well, that helped us move from one location to another better, faster, mostly safer. But there are other consequences that came around because of that. That's what I'm saying, Paul. We all should think about what it is that we're doing, why we're doing it, and develop an appreciation for the value of scientific inquiry and the value of technological advancements. That's what I'm saying.
And to his, the other point that he made was then when you're reading or looking at science studies or results or reading about somebody maybe poo-pooing the other person's comments about science, I mean, what kinds of places do you go to be more assured that at least the science you're reading about is based on something rigorous, let's put it that way?
Yes, that's very good. The sources of scientific information should be reliable, should be trustworthy. Social media, for the most part, as far as I'm concerned, are not reliable. It's somebody expressing, typing 140 characters or whatever it is that they're doing. Scientific journals have articles published in them that have been subjected to peer review to validate what is being said. It doesn't mean it's the final answer to any question. Let me give you an example. Early on, almost 4 years ago in 2020, we were just wiping everything because we thought that the transmission was happening through touch. Well, it didn't take too long for us to then learn that that's not the way the virus was transmitted. It was airborne. So that's an example of a short scale, short time scale understanding of how science works. Science informs us. It gives us knowledge. It gives us strength. It gives us confidence to ask more questions, to make sure that our understanding of the answers that we come up with are valid answers. So that's why I say, you know, really appreciating what science is, what technology does for us, those are important aspects of our democratic life, of the way we interact with each other. That's the strength and the beauty of being in America, that we do this in respectful ways.
You know, as we talk about science and achievements, I have to bring up that yesterday was the 100th anniversary of Carl Gerasi's birth. And I know you wanted to comment on him before the show was over. Who was Carl Gerasi and why is he important?
Carl Gerasi was a refugee from Nazi Europe. He was born 100 years ago yesterday. He came to America. He actually studied at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his PhD in chemistry in 2.5 years. Still holds the record for completing the PhD degree in that period of time. And Carl Gerasi worked very productively. He had three careers, one in industry, one in academic life, and one as a literary writer. So Carl Gerasi invented the first commercially viable antihistamine. You know, everybody knows about histamines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Carl Gerasi led the development of the first birth control pill, among other pharmaceuticals. He authored hundreds of scientific publications. He contributed to the practice of chemistry, utilizing techniques that relate to mass spectrometry, to circular dichroism, and so on. And then, Larry, in his late 60s, at the height of his scientific productivity, he closed down his laboratory at Stanford and started his third intellectual career, that of an author. He wrote poetry, he wrote plays, he wrote fiction. He was totally immersed in this. He wrote extensively about his own life, about his struggles with identity, about his search for belonging. And he published 271 entries on his literary list. That's more than many scientists publish in scientific literature in a lifetime. So Carl Gerasi's accomplishment changed our world. Let me just mention again, antihistamine, birth control pill, and other pharmaceuticals, all were studied, synthesized, and eventually through technology reached everyone around the world. I would say Carl has benefited the world in so many different ways. And there's so much to learn from his writings, his literary writings, his plays, his poetry. He was a very creative individual, and he greatly benefited from the freedom we have in America to live as human beings fully.
As a nation and the state of Wisconsin, TM wrote to us, we must prioritize science education by budgeting to pay decent wages for highly qualified classroom teachers. I don't think you'd disagree with that.
I agree with that. And we need to recognize the teachers not only with their pay, but with the contributions that they make. And we need to get more good people to go into teaching. We need to get more people to appreciate what good teachers do. It is a community activity that we should engage in. We should make sure that our school boards have members that care about the quality of life, including taking into consideration economic factors, social differences, everything. We need to really be in control of what we do in our immediate environment and what we do collectively outside of our immediate environment, in the classroom and especially outside the classroom. And I invite everyone to visit my website once again, scifund.org, where you'll find more about Carl Gerassi. You'll find more about science experiments you can do at home. To find out more about Carl Gerassi, just go to the homepage, scifund.org, and then look in one of the columns under the entry In Memoriam. Scan down In Memoriam until you find Carl Gerassi. And you'll find lots of things that Carl Gerassi did to help us, not only in America, but everywhere else around the world.
Bassam, it's always a pleasure. I will mention when you go to scifund.org, you're also going to, you mentioned science experiments, and I'm sure there are some on there that might be kind of fun to do tomorrow for Halloween.
There are many that you can do, not only tomorrow, but every day, Larry.
Thanks, Bassam. Always a pleasure. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, all listeners. Thank you.
Bassam Shakashiri, an emeritus professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, we're talking climate change a bit with Bassam, well, for quite a bit, actually. And our weather guys are coming up next, and they're going to take a look at some of the effects of climate change as well and zero in a little bit on sea ice. That's one way scientists can learn about the effects of climate change. And we'll get into that with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, next. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network.